New York City firefighter, all those buildings with asbestos insulation and 2 packs of Camels a day. I told her my mother was a secretary, even told her that she was the secretary to the head of a labor union. Soon I knew all about Craig and his pool business, about how Chelsea was afraid of thunderstorms, dogs, and insects, and how Chad was afraid of nothing. About Cindy's mom, Helen, and how she was one of the people who discovered that the Avon bath oil repelled mosquitoes, since the farm had more mosquitoes than crops. She was a second-generation Avon lady, Cindy was. She showed me the story in the Avon annual report about her and her mother. Her parents' farm was somewhere between Lake Plata and Jocasta, and her mother had logged sometimes 100 miles a day dropping off eyebrow pencil and bath oil beads to the wives of other farmers before the area was all built up, chock full of retired northerners and people who confuse sunshine with gold. Cindy went along when she got older, swiping those little sample lipsticks that the Avon lady left at our apartment for me and Gracie, even though our mother wouldn't buy a thing. A sea of moisturizer managed to keep Cindy's parents' place afloat, the thirsty faces of all those women baked leathery by the harsh Florida sun. Cindy and Craig had lived on the farm right after they were married, then built their own place in a subdivision 2 miles from the center of Lake Plata, in a redwood house with a lot of windows and an above-ground pool with some kind of automatic alarm on the surface so Chad wouldn't fall in and drown. Chelsea was afraid they'd all drown, in the pool, at the beach, in the tub. They lived at the end of a cul-de-sac, in an area of cul-de-sacs, as though by eliminating through roads the people who lived there could keep the rest of the world away. Every time I came for coffee, I took the measure of Cindy's kitchen, envying her no-wax linoleum and the double-door refrigerator with the automatic ice maker. But as my eyes roved around the white formica and the oak cabinets, I was really walking through my own house in my mind, up the 4 steps with the white iron railing, through the storm door and into the foyer with a half-round table and the gilded mirror over it, the one Bobby's mother gave us for a housewarming present. It's funny how you get about a house when you've never had one, never ever thought you'd have one. The day we signed all those papers, with 30 years this and 30 years that, passing around the checks like in some grown-up board game, we'd gone over to the house and wandered about like a couple of kids, our words echoing in the emptiness. Buying the house made it seem as though it was us that was so solid, made of brick and plaster so that nothing could blow us over. I remember looking up the stairs and it was like they were reaching up, not to 3 bedrooms and a bath with a glassed-in-stall shower, but to heaven. He'd shoved me a few times by then, even hit me in the stomach once. But I never looked up those stairs and imagined myself falling down them with a fist in the small of my back. "This is it, baby," he said, and he pulled me down to the wall-to-wall, his words echoing in the empty, stripped-down rooms. And it was. I got carpet burns on my butt that day, and I was the happiest woman in the world. People can talk about self-respect all they want, and people do plenty, usually when they're talking about somebody else's business. But whenever I thought about leaving, sometimes as much as leaving Bobby, I thought about leaving my house. Balloon shades and mini blinds, and the way I felt at night sleeping on my extra firm mattress under my own roof that we'd had hot tarred the year after Robert was born. All of it helped keep me there. And if that sounds foolish, just think about that solid, settled feeling you get when you open your cabinets, and there are the mugs for the coffee that have held the coffee day after day, year after year, hanging in a row from cup hooks, all the same color, the same size. Small things. Routine. Order. That's what kept me there for the longest time. That and love. That and fear. Not fear of Bobby. Fear of winding up in some low-rent apartment subdivision with a window that looked out on a wall. fear of winding up where I'd come from, where I was right now. It took me a dozen years of house pride and 17 years of marriage before I realized there were worse things than a cramped kitchen and grubby carpeting. I wondered how much damage Bobby had done to our house when he'd found us gone, with no one around to bruise or break. I wondered what he'd told his mother. Whether he'd told his friends or whether he'd just quietly set about the business of finding me. He had a half dozen friends who were on full pension and working as investigators. Maybe he'd called one of them. 130 days I'd been gone. August, September, October, November. Someone would have thought of Patty Bancroft by now. When a car pulled to the curb in front of the apartment complex at 2 in the morning, it rocked my world. Zindy gave me a bottle of melatonin, but I was afraid to take it, afraid to sleep deep. I dozed on and off each night, lulled by the sound of Robert's breathing over the baby monitor. It's funny. With all the elaborate preparations that Patty Bancroft's people had made, I never doubted that someday he would find us. I always felt like I was just buying time, the time it takes to raise one boy from child to adult. I never figured out how hard it was going to be to do that until I started. And then the bitch of it was that it was too late to turn back, though I wouldn't have turned back anyhow. The bitch of it was that it takes so much time and effort to make things good for them, and so little to make them bad. The bitch of it is that we're never sure whether what we're doing is right or wrong. Some of the damage is done. Robert watches too much, is too quiet. It's better when he's with other kids, but with adults he's always waiting for something to happen, like a psychic looking down at someone's palm. When he got thrown out of the supermarket, he was angry and upset, but he wasn't surprised. It was as though he knew that grown-ups at any moment might go off like car alarms, loud, scary, for no reason at all. The truth is, that's the way Bobby made him. And me too, by taking it. Robert has a look on his face too much of the time that people have when they think they've heard something moving around in the basement, heard the rumble of thunder so far away it just might be a truck in the next block. He had that look on his face that last time in Grace's apartment. That's how I think of the weeks before I left. The last time. The last time Bobby hit me. The last time I saw my sister. The last time I left my house, locking the door behind me. The last time in Grace's apartment I saw Robert's face change, saw it go still and watchful. Realized in a minute or two that he'd heard the elevator and the footsteps before we had been listening for them. His eyes were huge, but his shoulders hunched, as though he was trying to make himself small, smaller, tiny, invisible. Bang, at the door. Bang, and Robert shrinking into himself like a little old man. It's amazing how furious the sound of knuckles meeting wood can sound. "How the hell did he get upstairs?" Grace had said, and she made herself big, threw her bony shoulders back, marched in her clogs, bang, bang, to answer the banging at the door. "Go away, Bob, just go away. I want my wife and my son." I had been able to hear in Bobby's voice that he had been drinking, but not too much. "Now!" "Go away, Bob, you've done enough damage." "This is none of your goddamn business, Grace. Franny? Fran? You come out here and talk to me or I'll break the goddamn door down." I could feel Robert's shoulders vibrating beneath my fingertips, or maybe the vibrations were coming from inside me. "How the hell did he get up here?" Gracie said, all her freckles standing out against the white of her face, and from the other side of the thick oak door of her apartment came what sounded like a chuckle. "I showed the doorman my badge, Grace." That voice again. That deep bass line, music to someone's ears if not mine. You could just see him talking to the Russian émigré who minded the door of Grace's building, an old man in a faded blue-black uniform and ill-fitting hat. You could see Bobby flipping open the little leather case I'd given him when he made detective, and the doorman falling back before him, perhaps even touching his hand to the corner of his hat. Sometimes I thought how hard it was to be a cop, to put on the clothes and be force of law, and then take them off and be no more than a man with a cheap sports shirt and a stack of bills. But sometimes it made things easier. "Let him in," I said.
"No."
"Let him in, Grace. Or take Robert into the other room and I'll let him in." "Ah, hell, Francis," Bobby had said when I unlocked the deadbolt and the other two Yale locks. But whether it was because of my betrayal in leaving him and going to Grace, or because of the look of my face, which was mottled purple and black where it wasn't covered with adhesive tape, I don't know. Maybe he didn't know how bad he'd hurt me. He'd come in after midnight the night before and banged around the kitchen and the living room looking for something, muttering furiously to himself, waking me from a sound sleep so that I couldn't go off again. I don't know why I went downstairs. I've asked myself that so many times, no matter what Patty Bancroft likes to say on television about placing blame where blame belongs. All I know is that if I'd done what I'd done so many times before, pretended to be asleep, ignored the staccato sounds of rage from below, I'd still be sleeping in my own bed now, and my son in his. Or maybe not. If it hadn't been my nose on a Wednesday in late July, it would have been my jaw on a Saturday in September. I suppose that's true. Like a cloud to a storm to a hurricane, the thing between us had gotten bigger and blacker every day, until maybe it was bound to pick us up, smash us down, leave us all in ruins, in Lake Plata. There wasn't even an argument. Or maybe Bobby had been having an argument with me in his head all day long, on the job, in the car, while he was banging around the kitchen. Maybe it was an argument made of saved string, a big, brightly colored ball of an argument, the synthesis of all the arguments we'd ever had before. "Why the fuck do you baby the boy, go to your sister's, ignore my mother, wear that skirt, work so many hours, look at me like that, fuck my friends, your friends, strangers, doctors, everyone, anyone, the man in the moon?" I'd stumbled down the stairs and into the hall in my long white nightgown, and the light hurt my eyes and I couldn't see his, could only see half a dozen drawers and cabinets gaping open as though he was looking for something. He probably was. Bobby was always looking for something, and neither of us knew what it was. "Bobby, what is your problem?" I'd said, squinting in the light. And it happened. Just like that. Three good punches that I remember, and then I came to maybe an hour later, covered in blood. My nose and tongue numb. I'd broken one and bitten right through the edge of the other. I'd fixed myself up with bacitracin and bandages and gone to bed right beside him. I know people will find it hard to understand that, but it was my bed. I belonged there. I wasn't going to be thrown out of my own bed no matter what. I woke once to hear Bobby sending Robert off to school, pretended to be asleep when I heard our bedroom door open. I called in to work sick when Bobby was gone, waited for Robert to come home, spent $25 on a cab and took him to Grace's and let myself in and waited there in the shadows, no lights on. Her apartment cheaper because it was at the back of the building. Robert fell asleep in her bedroom. "I broke my nose," I said when Grace came in with her briefcase and her tote bag full of books. She stood there, my baby sister, still that even if she is 32, and her own face crumpled, and she sat on the arm of the sofa and took my head in her hands. She's little, Grace, but strong in her bones and muscles somehow. She lifts weights, too, just like Bobby, And when she raises those skinny arms over her head to stretch, you can see all the connections in her body, everything. Biceps, triceps, shoulder muscles like rubber bands. "No, you didn't," she said. "You didn't break your nose. Don't you ever say you broke your nose. Someone else broke your nose. That son of a bitch, that bastard. I told Mom he was doing this. I told Mom about all these things that happened to you. That big bruise you had the last time we had lunch. The time you had the marks all over your one arm. And you know what she said? She said you always were a clumsy kid. Jesus God, if she could see you now." We sat at Grace's round oak dining table, Bobby and I, while Grace took Robert into her bedroom. It was a small apartment, and the table was really at one end of the living room by casement windows that looked out over a sliver of 104th Street. "Where are you gonna sleep here? On the couch?" he said. "Where's Robert gonna sleep?" "Look at my face," I said. "My son should be in my house, not in some shithole on the Upper West Side. You don't know this area like I do. He could get hurt here." "Look at my face," I said. "I'm taking you home," he said. "No." "Then I'm taking Robert home." "I won't let you." Then Bobby looked at my face. Looked at it good. Looked at it with a cold, cold look that he, for all the things he had done to me, had never given me before. And, like he'd been rehearsing it, he said, real quiet, "What are you gonna do, Fran? Call the cops?" That's when I knew. That's when I knew that this was the last time, that I was leaving. If there was a moment when I decided that Bobby Benedetto would never touch me again, it was at that moment. He was gloating, really, although for once you couldn't read his mood in his voice. He was telling me that I was trapped, that I was chained in some basement he'd created, a basement with flowered ironstone dishes all laid out neatly in the cupboards, with silk flowers in a vase on the dining room table. He was telling me that I'd never get away, that he could do what he wanted and I couldn't do a thing about it. As we were leaving, Gracie pulled me back into the little foyer for just a moment. "Please don't do this, Franny," she said. "I'll help you. I'll do anything to help you." "How?" I said. I was asleep on my feet, and my face hurt so much that the pain was all I could think of. "I'll think of something," she said. "He's going to take my kid, Gracie," I said. "We can stop him," she said. I laughed then, even though it hurt, a bitter, choking chuckle halfway to a sob. "What are we going to do, Grace? Call a cop?" I said. That night I gave up and slept on the floor in Robert's room. Bobby saw the puddle of pillow and blanket on the floor and tried to put his hand out to me. I cringed, pulled away, then looked him full in the face. Once I saw a man in the psych ward reading the notebooks he'd written, before he'd been given anti-hallucinogens, reading the gibberish he'd written frantically, fanatically, as though it was the secret of the universe. Bobby looked a little like that when I pulled back from his big hand. I'd taken two Percocets I had left over from having my wisdom teeth out, and when I woke up, my one cheek beating with every beat of my heart, the sun was making shards of daylight across the blue carpeting, and the house was empty. I ran from room to room calling Robert's name, and finally I called the principal of his school, who called the counselor at the school day camp, who said that he was in gym, playing pillow polo. There were only 10 days left of day camp. We were renting a house at the beach for the first 2 weeks of August, a cottage on Long Island Sound, but I wasn't going. I'd called a family planning clinic in Lower Manhattan to make an appointment for the next day. Then I'd called Patty Bancroft. And I bet Bobby thought it was because he'd broken my nose and bloodied my face. He had never touched my face before. It was as though, as never before, he'd touched my insides. Who I was, who I am. And it was his threat, too, that made me understand that I had to run to hide, to get away. What was I going to do? Call a cop? But maybe it was Robert who made me run, really. It was the look on his face on the way home from Grace's apartment that last time. The look on his face as we passed under the streetlight on our corner. The look on his face was nothing. Nothing at all. The look he might have if he were watching a boring movie on television or playing with his food at the dinner table. The part of a little boy that would be frightened if his father threatened his mother and his aunt. The part of him that would be scared and screaming if his mother's face was all bruised and bloodied. That part of Robert was dead. Or been driven so deep inside that you couldn't see it and he couldn't feel it. I saw it for a moment when he came home that next day from day camp and saw me in the kitchen in the sunlight. I saw the kind of horror and fear that a normal kid would feel. But then it was gone again. His face flat and closed, as he asked me whether I'd had an accident. So many accidents during his childhood, all of them lies. That's why I left when I did. How I did. During the long nights of a Florida winter, alive with wind sounds and whispers, as I imagined that Bobby was on the roof, at the door, jimmying a window open, I had a lot of time to think. And that's the truth. That's why I left. I'm a nurse, you know, a Catholic girl, a mother, and the wife of a man who wanted to suck the soul out of me and put it in his pocket. I'm not real good at doing things for myself. But for Robert, that was a different story. Oh, goodness gracious, you must be Beth. And Robert. Cindy was right. Her mother was thin and dark, as though she'd been dried by the sun. A raisin of a woman with her daughter's big blue eyes and electric smile. She stood aside to let us into the house, her arm extended as though we were being welcomed to something magical. Merry Christmas, Craig said, getting up from the couch, a mug of eggnog with snowflakes painted on it in his hand. Merry Christmas, said Mike Reardon, who was sitting next to him.
Hi, Mr. Reardon, said Robert. What are you doing here?
You come in here, Beth, Cindy shouted from inside the kitchen. When I'd been younger, I'd worked at the hospital sometimes on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, ceding the holiday to the older women with children and in-laws to cook for. But even in the lounge of the medical surgical floor or the emergency room, we managed to construct our own traditions. The fancy trays of meats and cheeses studded with radish roses, the plates of cannoli and cream puffs, the tiny tree with felt ornaments that one of the aides made, with each of our names spelled out on a bell or a star in glue and glitter. And later we'd made our own Christmases, Bobby and Robert and I. Christmas Eve dinner at Ann Benedetto's, scungili and calamari and bacala, the walk home through a cold Brooklyn night along streets bright as day with lit-up lawn reindeer and sleighs, and Mr. Costanza's house that got in the Daily News every year because it took $500 worth of Con Ed juice to light it for a week. Morning mass at St. Stanny's, the kids clutching whichever toy was the favorite that year, Ninja Turtles, Power Rangers, Battle Beasts, dinner in the early evening. And after the guests were gone and the dishwasher was humming and Robert was in bed, his new toys ranged around him like a bulwark, the smell of fresh plastic and evergreen in the air, Bobby would put on his Nat King Cole album, and at the words chestnuts roasting on an open fire, he would take me in his arms and dance me slowly, seriously, around our small and narrow living room,
singing along in a baritone grown a little uncertain with age. I can feel him, smell him, if I close my eyes and hum that song to myself. It was Florida weather that had saved me, as I'd climbed out of bed that morning to dress. It was as warm as April in New York, so that it made it hard to believe in reindeer in the snow or sleigh rides. Even Robert felt it. "It's weird to wear a short-sleeved shirt to Christmas," he had said as he loaded new batteries into his video game. That was the new word, weird. "It's weird to be going to somebody else's house for Christmas," he said later, eating his cereal. "It's weird not to have a bigger tree," he mumbled, putting his bowl in the sink. "That was the biggest tree I could afford," I said, my voice quavering. "Those were the presents I could afford. This is the kind of Christmas I could afford." "It just feels weird," Robert said, his own voice unsteady, and I'd hugged him hard then. "It's weird not to be with your father," I said, "and Aunt Grace and Grandmom. It's the hardest thing in the world not to be with the people you love on Christmas Day." "But I'm with you," he said. So sweet sometimes, the way he would say things like that, as though just like his father, he was two people, the one who hated where he was and the one who'd made his peace with it, as I'd begun to do. I wondered, just for a moment, whether Bobby had done the same thing, whether even now he was sitting with a glass of red wine saying, "Ah, good riddance," to one of his cop friends while the wife checked on whether the ham was ready to glaze and the kids bickered over their new toys. But I looked down at Robert's shining hair and knew that that couldn't be true, no matter how much I wanted it. "My son," Bobby used to call him, "my boy." That possessive pronoun, "my wife, my girl," he'd never give us up. Somewhere, somehow, I knew that he was listening to that Christmas song and seething. Robert went up the stairs of the Rohrbacher house to help Chad with his new Duplo blocks, and I went into the kitchen to arrange Cindy's baking powder biscuits on a cookie sheet. "Mama, honey, go sit back down," Cindy said, when Helen Manford followed me, pulling idly at the cord on a little Santa pin that made his eyes light up red and faintly demonic. "I had a pin like that when I was a kid," I said. "I had a red Christmas coat one year, and I wore that pin on the lapel." Mrs. Manford smiled. Farm or no farm, dirt or no dirt, she still had a kind of beauty, with a grace of bone and posture that would forever survive sun and long hours and hard work. Next to her, her daughter, with her bright lips and hair in a curly twist, looked like a jumped-up imitation of the real thing. "Go ahead and tell her," Cindy said, sipping some white wine, pouring me a glass. I could hear the men from the living room, like the rumble of thunder. "I got this one when I was a girl, too. 14, I think. I loved it so dearly that I managed to hold on to it. I even got the jeweler up on the highway to find some kind of new battery for it when it wouldn't light up anymore. Once when I was 7 or 8, Cindy said, "there was a hurricane, and they evacuated us all to the high school. Mama's running around, getting the picture albums and the records from the farm bills and invoices and all that. All of a sudden, she lets out this little yelp, runs back into her bedroom, and comes out with her hand in a fist. 'Oh, for pity's sake, Helen,' my dad says, and sure enough, it's Santa. 'You'd better take good care of him when he's yours.' 'Oh, for pity's sake, Mama, you'll live forever.'" Cindy turned down a fruit sauce bubbling on the back of the stove. "I'm gonna kill us all with this meal." "I don't want to hear one word about cholesterol on Christmas Day," Mrs. Manford said. "There's too much of that as there is. Cynthia Lee, it's not a good idea for you to be drinking and cooking at the same time. You'll burn yourself on that stove." "It's a glass of wine, Mama. Want one?"
"No, ma'am," said Mrs. Manford.
"Take these spiced pecans out to the table for those guys to munch on,"
Cindy said, handing her mother a bowl.
"Well, they smell good," Mrs. Manfred said doubtfully, carrying the food into the next room.
"There's a guest in that living room that you didn't tell me about," I said to Cindy.
"Well, since you two are such friends, I figured I didn't need to," Cindy said. "Hold this chafing dish."
She poured creamed onions into it, then waved me over to the table and handed me a silver lid. "That's all you're going to say?"
"Oh, for pity's sake. The poor man has his mama and two of his sisters coming with their kids tomorrow. He told Mrs. Petranian he was going to stay home today and straighten up his place. She was going to take him home and feed him lamb and some terrible bean stuff she was telling me about. You should have invited him yourself."
"We were coming here."
"So see, I saved you the trouble."
"You should have said."
"Good thing you dressed nice. You look good in green. Not like most blondes who just look washed out."
She squinted at me.
"Wait a minute, wait a minute. I'm not so drunk that I don't notice you're not wearing your glasses. You finally get contacts?"
"Leave me in peace and give me something to do," I said.
"You knew he was coming after all,"
Cindy crowed, and I hit her with a dish towel.
Cindy's Christmas was ham, with raisin sauce and mashed sweet potatoes with marshmallows browning on top, creamed onions and baby peas, papier-mâché angels on the mantel in the living room, and a silvery white artificial tree with red lights and ornaments.
I know it's tacky," she said when I caught her buying evergreen fragrance in a can, "but I can't stand picking pine needles out of my carpet."
Craig was tending a fire in the fireplace, although it was almost 70 degrees outside and the air conditioning was on. He and Mike and his father-in-law were talking about the football standings, pro, college, and local high school, and whether the mayor of Lakota was a crook, a smart politician, or both. Cindy's father, Ed, leaned forward and did most of the talking. He was a short fireplug of a man. While Craig was tall and quiet, a big bony man with a thatch of gray-brown hair, whose smile seemed to be a kind of muscle spasm he neither controlled nor invited. When he and Cindy were in the same room, it felt as though they'd divvied up the parts of their marriage, and Cindy, along with kids and home decor, had gotten the part that controlled laughter and sociability. "He's my rock," she liked to say of Craig, and there was something stony, fossilized about him, a man prematurely old at 40. But I was inclined to like him because of the way he let Cindy clean up around him and chide him for his bottle caps and missing buttons as though nothing could be more welcome or more sensible than being chided. I liked him even more that night, when he rose beneath a brass chandelier that was bound and gagged in an endless rope of fake greenery and red ribbon, a dish towel tucked in the waistband of his pants, raised a glass of white wine and said, "Merry Christmas to all. Thank you for joining us, Mike and Beth and Robert."
"Thank you," I said.
"Don't speak too soon, miss," said Ed Manfred, bent over his plate. "You haven't tasted any of this yet. Maybe you don't know that our girl has a reputation as a chef."
He laughed, one of those short, barking laughs that seems to be the specialty of small men and that are never really mirthful.
"And I'm not talking Julia Child, that's for sure."
"Here we go,"
Cindy said under her breath.
"You're a nurse or a nurse's aide or something, aren't you? You ever dealt with a case of ptomaine? Bark, bark. There's Pepto in the bathroom, isn't there, Craig?"
"Ed, don't start,"
said Helen Manfred, turning her sweet potatoes over with her fork as though she expected to find something buried inside them.
"Did she tell you about her first try at home cooking?"
Ed Manfred added, leaning toward me until his beefy upper arm was against the side of my breast and I was back as far as I could go in my chair.
"Barbecued chicken, done to a turn, brown and crispy like out of a picture in a cookbook. Just one little thing."
The bark again, this time with more of an edge.
She didn't defrost it. Red and raw and all bloody inside. Good thing we had some bologna in the icebox.
That was 20 years ago, Dad, Cindy said.
She made a picnic last year for the soccer tournament, Mike said. That was the best fried chicken I ever had. And that chocolate cake you brought, that was great, too.
Remember that barbecue they had for the girl's third birthday, Al?
Mr. Manford said, as though Mike had said nothing at all.
I was in the bathroom for the rest of the evening. I never figured whether it was the potato salad or the spare ribs.
No one else had a problem, Cindy said.
But he didn't pay any attention.
How's your ham, Helen? He asked. Done enough?
It's perfect, said Craig Rohrbacher. Everything's perfect, as usual.
Really? Great meal, Cindy, great meal, said Mike.
Not a whole lot of money in teaching, is there? Mr. Manford said.
Nope, Mike said. You have to love it. He smiled at me. And have a sense of humor.
Spoon, 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 spoon! Shouted Chad from the children's table set at one end of the room.
Pipe down, little boy, said Ed Manford, shoveling in his food.
Spoon! Chad yelled again happily. You be a good boy now, said Helen. Leave him alone, Mama, said Cindy. It's Christmas.
Over at the children's table, Robert was whispering to Chad and feeding him sweet potatoes, teaching him his favorite party trick. Being good, being quiet, teaching him to make himself disappear when the grown-ups started to raise their voices. We all had coffee afterward in the living room, the fire burning blue in the stone fireplace, Mr. Manford asleep in the recliner chair. Both Cindy and her mother took aspirin after dinner. Chelsea hit Chad with Holiday Barbie because he'd disarranged the doll's hair. She'd been sent to her room, where she'd fallen asleep, sprawled across her bed in a red lace party dress.
"You're not supposed to be mean at Christmas, Mommy," she sobbed as she went up the stairs, Barbie's head going bump, bump, bump on the treads.
Robert read One Fish, Two Fish to Chad. I could tell, because from time to time I could hear Chad shout, "Fish!" from upstairs.
"I told him if he went to sleep I'd kick the soccer ball with him tomorrow," Robert said when he finally came downstairs.
Bless you, sweetie, Cindy said, her head tilted back in the circle of her husband's arm. From upstairs we all heard the word faintly,
ball, ball.
All of us laughed except for Mr. Manford, who was snoring, and Mrs. Manford, who was cleaning the kitchen, though Cindy had tried three or four times to persuade her not to. Mike drove us home, of course. Cindy'd asked him before we'd even arrived. The lights of the strip were glowing like decorations in the mist, but for the first time since we'd come to Lake Plata, maybe the only time all year, all the parking lots were empty. As though of one accord, we had all decided to take one day off from cheap hamburgers and labor-saving appliances and instead come together in our living rooms. We passed house trailers set back behind the Price Club warehouse, and tiny cinder-block houses that couldn't possibly have more than two rooms. And I was certain that each had some Christmas tradition, and perhaps as much of a divide between what we felt and what we wanted to feel as there'd been at Cindy's that night. I couldn't help thinking of how Cindy had once been in love with Jackson Islington, who wanted to settle down on a farm. I couldn't help thinking of Ed Manford's stubby hands, a faint tracery of black soil etched in so deep that it would never come out, no matter how much he scrubbed. He'd eaten everything on his plate, then taken seconds. How in the world did that hateful man ever produce someone as sweet as Cindy? I said in a low voice after looking in back to make sure Robert was occupied with his new video game. That's a good question, Mike said. You see it all the time. Some really good kids with terrible parents, and some great parents with tough kids.
And then you've got Cindy and Craig, who seem so grounded, with Chelsea, who was scared to death of everything. Cindy couldn't use the electric knife for the ham because it freaks Chelsea out.
I've never seen the point of an electric knife. It's just as easy to carve with the old-fashioned kind.
Cindy said that as soon as Chelsea hears it humming, she starts to think someone's going to cut a hand off.
I think the fear thing has to have something to do with Cindy's sister. I imagine that's why Cindy's parents are so strange with her, too. They'd probably look at Cindy and see Kathy, although you'd think they'd be grateful to have Cindy and be a little nicer to her.
Cindy doesn't have a sister.
She did. She didn't tell you?
He shook his head.
That's weird. It's one of those famous stories that every town has. Sooner or later, she must have known someone would tell you.
Cindy was an identical twin. From what I've heard, Mrs. Manford really used to do it up the way people used to with twins, twin girls mostly. Curls and Mary Janes and matching dresses and all that. The story I heard was that one day their mother sent Kathy out to their cornfield to call Mr. Manford in for dinner. He was on one of those big tractors, those John Deeres with the huge wheels they use around here, where you sit up high off the ground. Apparently, he never even saw her. Someone told me he thought he hit a rock.
Jesus Christ, I said. Yeah. If I'd been the father, it would have killed me. But I'd also like to think it would make me treasure the one I had left.
I can't believe Cindy never told me.
Maybe it's too hard for her to talk about it, he said as he pulled up in front of the house. Here we are.
Robert had fallen asleep in the back, his game still buzzing in his hand. Mike Reardon carried him inside, laid him on the couch, and turned to go.
Our living room had a small tree stuck in a bucket of wet sand, decorated with glass balls and paper apples I'd found at the discount drugstore, and beneath it were a few packages. I handed him one.
Merry Christmas, I said. I didn't bring it tonight because I didn't know you were going to be there.
I didn't know you were coming either.
He lifted the green jacket from its box, held it up in front of him as though he'd never seen a jacket before, had no idea what it was used for or what it might be. Robert stirred on the couch, then sat up.
That's a good jacket, Robert said faintly.
If you've already got one, I said.
No, Mike said. Thank you. I really needed this.
He laughed. I'll drop your presents by tomorrow. I didn't bring them because I didn't know. You know.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Reardon, said Robert. Mr. Reardon was weird about his present, Robert said later as I tucked him in.
I think he didn't like it, but he was trying to be polite, I said.
I liked everything I got, Robert said.
Me too, I said. I love you, Ba.
I held him for a moment and realized that he was beginning to feel different in my arms, more geometric, less soft. The tears slid down my cheeks and onto his face. I love you too, Mom, he said. I had a really good Christmas. Don't be sad.
I'm not, hon, I'm not.
In the kitchen, I picked up the phone, put it down, picked it up again. I wasn't even sure who I wanted to call. Or who I could afford to call. Patty Bancroft had called me 3 days before when the phone bills came to ask icily about the 23-minute call to New York on the evening of November 24th. It hadn't felt like 23 minutes, those precious minutes on the phone to Grace. It had felt like no time at all. You have no idea what can be done with phone records, Patty Bancroft had said coldly. How could anyone see my phone records? I haven't even seen them. I don't even know where they're delivered.
Holidays are a difficult time, Elizabeth, she'd said. People call home during the holidays, and people who are looking for them know that. And getting a copy of a phone record for someone who knows how is nothing. Nothing at all.
I'd hated the tone of her voice, as though she were talking to a child, a teenage girl who talked too long to her friends, a stupid adolescent with no idea of the results of her actions. But she'd scared me. I picked up the receiver in the kitchen, then put it down, then picked it up again. The dial tone turned into the manic, high-pitched beeping of a phone off the hook, and I could hear the sing-song murmur of the recorded message, "If you wish to place a call." Finally, I hung up, then picked the phone up once more and dialed the number on an index card tacked to the kitchen door jamb. "Hello?" she said, her voice a little hoarse, as though she had not had cause to use it that day. "Hi, Mrs. Levitt. It's Beth Crenshaw. I know it's late, but is it all right if I say Merry Christmas?" In the background, I heard the sound of conversation, even music. "Is this a bad time?" I added.
"Ach, no," she said. "Irving and I are watching White Christmas, aren't we, Irving? A Christmas movie, what can it hurt? Not like having a tree, right? That Rosemary Clooney, it's a shame how heavy she got. She was a nice-looking girl when she was young."
"She was, wasn't she?"
"But you can tell, the ones that have to watch it when they get a little older, or next thing you know, a backside out to here. Now she wears nothing but muumuus."
"But a beautiful voice."
"Beautiful. Merry Christmas, Mrs. Nurse. I'll tell you something. Irving likes you. I can tell. This one you like, Irving," I said. "I'm glad. Tell him I said thank you. We'll see you Tuesday, won't we, Irving? I have a little something for the little boy."
And then I called Cindy, even though I'd just left her. "I just wanted to say thanks again," I said. "You saved my life with that dinner and the presents and everything." I thought of Cindy's twin, of the early years when she'd been able to look at a mirror image without even looking in the mirror, of sitting in the kitchen or their room or wherever she was when Kathy went out to call Ed Manford for dinner, of her hearing the shouting, the screams. Or maybe not. Maybe just hearing a silence where a moment before ordinary life had been. It had been a good story, that story about Jackson Islington, but it hadn't been the real story. Although I couldn't complain. It had been a good story I'd told her, the story of the nuns, but it hadn't been the real story either. "I love you, kid," I said.
"Love you, honey," she said. "I gotta go to bed, I had too much wine."
And in the kitchen, I poured myself a glass of water and drank it by the living room window, looked out over the dark quadrangle hung with motley lights from a gap I made with my two fingers in the blinds. Finally, I went to bed, with Nat King Cole playing over and over in my head, with my stomach roiling with wine. I thought of Ed Manford leaning so close to me, of Cindy's sister disappearing beneath the big ridged wheels of a farm tractor. And I thought of Bobby. The Christmas before, he'd given me a half heart, cut down the center with a jagged line hanging on a heavy gold chain. The other half he'd hung around his own neck, on the chain where he wore his miraculous medal, the image of the Virgin Mary his father had been given by his own parents when he became a cop, that Anne Benedetto had refused to have buried with her husband, had given to her son instead. I'd left the half-heart in my jewelry box, below the costume things. But I knew Bobby had found it. His heart, jettisoned, left. Maybe that had been enough. Maybe he had let me go. Maybe he was singing Nat King Cole into some other woman's ear, some woman he'd found to take my place, a woman who didn't make him angry or mean, who got all the good stuff and none of the bad. As Christmas Day darkened and deepened into the morning of the day after, I fell asleep, wondering. The next morning, Mike Reardon came by with two packages, beautifully, extravagantly wrapped, the work of a department store gift-wrapping department, all foil stars and glittery ribbon.
"I thought you had company today," I said.
"They're coming at 3, he said. "I cleaned up by stuffing everything in the closets."
For Robert, he had gotten a Yankees baseball shirt, blue and white pinstripes. For me, there was a runner's rain jacket, lightweight, deep green. It was more or less the same jacket I'd given him, except that his was size large, mine size small. The look on my face must have been funny.
"Don't tell Cindy," Mike said, "or she'll talk about it till next Christmas."
There was something called a safe home party, with kids, balloons, hot dog wagons, and clowns, at the school on New Year's Eve. Mike so busy that I only got to wave at him across a very crowded cafeteria. And then the holidays were over. Soccer ebbed, basketball flowed. Robert had practiced 3 times a week after school, games every weekend, enough homework that he moved straight from his desk to the sink to brush his teeth and wash his face for bed. Jennifer got a new wheelchair and taught me to play a computer game called Knockout. She always won, the high score table a list of variations on her name and initials. Cindy and I ran a sale of books the library no longer needed, our hands and faces gray with the dust of years. And one day, at the end of January, walking home from the Levitts, seeing familiar lights and now familiar windows, it occurred to me that the tedium of this life had become comforting, that it felt real and lasting in its sheer ordinary drudgery, that in the same way I found it restful to run a route I'd run dozens of times before, so it had become restful to do these small tasks that I knew by heart, that asked no more of me than a kind of rote recitation of the body. I was less fearful, but not foolhardy. I still scanned every crowd, at the mall, at the ball games, as careful as a snitch looking for a hitman. Not just for Bobby, for his dark head, his hawkish profile, but for his Uncle Gerald, or some cop now retired who'd once shared a squad car with him, or a woman who knew us both from St. Stanley's. America turns out to be a very small country if you're trying to get lost in it. Mention you're from Omaha, and it's a cinch. Any stranger you meet will say he has a cousin there. It's why I had been able to come to Lake Plata and be absorbed by the town as completely as a stone falling into deep water. Because there was no town, really. Just a collection of strangers ranged around a commercial strip. No families who had lived on one block for 3 generations, or even the remnants of that sort of life, a son or a daughter living in a house a block or 2 away from where their parents had raised them. One Saturday, we went to a carnival outside town to celebrate the first win of the Pee Wee basketball team. Every carnival is the same carnival. Literally. If you read the name on the tickets they make you buy in vast quantities for the rides, or look at the gaudy logos painted on trucks parked around the outskirts of the glittering circle, you might see the same name in an empty field in Florida as you see in a high school parking area in Westchester or outside a mall in Oak Park, Illinois. West Hammer Amusements, Jensen Amusements, Richter Amusements. They just hook it all up to trailers or throw it all on flatbeds. The haunted house, the midway games with their bad odds and cheap toy prizes, the Tilt-A-Whirl and Cyclone. 3 days later, they pack it all up and haul it to the next town. Bobby would never let Robert go on any rides at a carnival. "Look at these dirt bags," he'd whisper if Buddy or Jimmy or one of the other guys managed to drag us to one instead of just barbecuing in their backyards. "How tight do you think they made the screws on those things? Those look to you like the kinds of guys that take a lot of trouble with a wrench?" Not even the little boats that traveled in a tiny circle in a track of fetid water 2 feet deep, or the cars that were lower to the ground than Robert's tricycle. Someone else's children would be screaming from the dragon wagon, waving at us as the cars thundered up and down the track. And Robert would be standing, big-eyed, next to Bobby, a hand in his, as though my failure to recognize the clear and undeniable danger of this place removed me from them both.
crackerjack he could have, and cotton candy. But no hot dogs or sausage and peppers cooked on a big griddle by women with tattoos.
"What are you, nuts, Francis?"
Bobby would say.
"You want a hot dog?" I said to Robert while I was taking food orders and we were trying to settle the boys on some splintered picnic benches.
He nodded, then smiled.
It felt like something to me, maybe a moving on, a moving over to some other place where we made new rules and traditions. Hot dogs were no longer dangerous. We were living a different life. Every once in a while, at moments like this, it felt like mine.
"Mrs. Bernson asked us in school to talk about an adventure," Robert had said one night over leftover lasagna. "I talked about it being an adventure to move to a new place where you've never been before and where you don't know anyone."
I'm not sure what showed in my face, but he'd added quickly, "I didn't talk about before. Just now. Like meeting Benny and everything."
"You are the best boy in the world," I'd said.
Mr. Castro was working nights as a janitor at the paper products plant and had agreed to come along to the carnival to help Mike and me keep the boys in order. He'd brought Benny's little sister Sandy, who had just turned 5, as a special treat for her birthday. He held tight to her hand as she danced and smiled and cried, "Popcorn, Papa, popcorn, please!" Jason Illing's father was there with his video camera, just as he was at every game, filming Jason slumped on the bench, the boy's shoulders bowing to his belly like an old man, filming the 2 minutes or so that Mike, who played everyone, cut no one, gave Jason to play. "Hold up your burger," Mr. Illing called, but Jason ignored him and hunched over his Dutch fries and his root beer. Cindy came with us, too, after one of the other boys' mothers backed out. She had Chad in the stroller, and I'd managed to coax Chelsea from the little niche between Cindy's torso and the stroller handle onto a picnic bench, where she ate a hot dog slowly and thoughtfully.
"I don't like rides," Chelsea said.
"Can I tell you a secret?" I said. "Neither do I. They always make me feel like I'm going to throw up."
Chelsea nodded.
11, 12, I heard Mike muttering to himself, and I laughed.
"They're all here," I said.
"It's hard to keep track of 16 of them in a place like this," he said.
"I know, but you don't really need to keep track of 16. Jason is under constant electronic surveillance. I never let Robert out of my sight, and Robert never makes a move without Benny. Mr. Castro is keeping an eye on Jonathan, who always gives Benny a hard time. That leaves 12, and Cindy and I divided the 12 up on the bus, so all you really have to do is hand out tickets."
Of course, it wasn't as simple as that once the leavings of their lunch were bundled into wax paper and tinfoil and chucked, underhand, overhand, Jonathan Green from behind his brawny back, and why was I so happy when he missed by a foot, into the metal drums used for trash.
"Tilt-a-whirl," Mike yelled, and as of one accord, most of the group would move toward the ride, and some would scatter, to knock down weighted milk bottles with a hardball, to buy junky jewelry or sugar-coated nuts, to look at the Army Reserve tank.
"Can I put you in charge of stragglers?" I asked Cindy, who was trying to get mustard out of her shirt with a paper napkin and a cup of water she'd wangled out of the homemade lemonade stand.
"Not with herself hanging on to my midsection," she said, looking down at Chelsea. "I'm straggling myself."
"Chels," I said, bending down, "will you come with me, and we'll make sure the guys are okay on the rides?"
"I don't want to go on."
"Me neither. That's why I need your help." Her hand in mine was sweaty but sweetly curved. Cindy had put her hair into a French braid, and she was wearing pink shorts and a matching shirt with ruffles of lace around the legs and sleeves.
"You look so pretty today," I said.
"So do you," Chelsea said. "You look nice in a dress."
"It's a T-shirt dress, not a real dress. Your mom bought this for me for Christmas."
"I know. She likes to buy people clothes."
"They're making me go on," Mike shouted from a car on the tilt-a-whirl, wedged in between two of the smaller boys, his arms around each one. When he came off, he was rolling his eyes. The only way you keep from throwing up is by fixing on one stationary point and staring at it, he said.
Really?
That's my theory.
Did it work?
So far, he said, I just stared straight at you. I could feel the color come up in my face, see it in his.
What next? I said.
How about dinner and a movie? We both looked down.
Never mind. I can't believe I said that. Jesus, Reardon.
Beth, I have to go to the bathroom really bad,
Chelsea said.
We'll be at the House of Horrors, Mike said.
When we got back, they were all still in line. Jason's father was panning the row of boys, calling, "And your name is?" to each. A group of retarded children and their teachers were ahead of them. The children were wearing name tags and smiling, dancing in the sunshine, rolling their eyes at the demons and ghouls painted on the outside of the House of Horrors.
"Are you sure?" one of the teachers kept asking, and they all nodded.
But once inside, we could hear shrieks and wails, and the ticket taker flicked his cigarette into the grass and swore.
"Keep your people back," he barked at Mike, who threw out his arms as though to restrain a regiment of unruly soldiers. "Bring them back out," he yelled into the House of Horrors. And a moment later, the teachers and the children hurried through the black door and down the up ramp, the adults rosy with embarrassment, the children drenched in sweat as though in an instant every bad thing they had ever imagined had come at them by the light of the cheap strobe, ready to rip their hearts out.
"Wow," said Chelsea.
"Go ahead," the ticket taker yelled at Mike.
"Are you guys still up for this?" Mike said, turning around.
"Oh, for Christ's sake," said the ticket taker.
After that, there was the Viper, and then the bumper cars. Chelsea thought about the bumper cars, but then she saw sparks fly from the tether to the ceiling when one of them hit the wall.
"Are you going to go on anything at all?" said Cindy. "Anything? They have pony rides." "Maybe in a little while," she said.
"Pretty girl," said Mr. Castro.
"Thank you. Say thank you, hon,"
Cindy said a little too loudly. Then Christopher Menendez threw up, and Mr. Castro took him to the men's room.
"Oh, my Lord, please don't put him in my car on the way home," Cindy said.
"This was a bad idea," Mike said.
"No, it wasn't," I said. "This is just one of those things that sounds a lot better before and after than when you're actually doing it."
"That's what I like about her," he said, turning to Cindy. "Most women would say, 'Yeah, it was a bad idea. Let's get out of here.'
Or they'd say, 'No, it was a great idea. We're having a great time.' And you'd know it was bull. Instead, she said what she just said, which happens to be true and accurate."
"That's what I like about her, too," Cindy said, in a voice that sounded as though she was playing the ingenue in the school play.
"Ferris wheel and then call it a day?" Mike said.
"Sure," I replied.
Cindy looked at her manicure and then at Mike's back as he plowed through the crowds to the place by the bumper cars where he'd told the boys to assemble after their fifth go-round. She rubbed the nail on her index finger with a frown, as though she'd found a flaw in the finish. Chad was splayed in the stroller fast asleep.
"I'm not going to say anything," she finally said.
"Good," I said.
Both of us lapsed into the tired silence of adults who have been with children.